Hey, pull up a chair. It's Hacks on Tap with David Axelrod and Mike Murphy.
The government knows what is happening. Look, our military knows where they took off from. If it's a garage, they can go right into that garage. They know where it came from and where it went. And for some reason, they don't want to comment.
All right, Mike Murphy, there he is, the president-elect, jumping into the whole drone, episode. And Heilman, you're here too. Year-end show. We're all together. Speaking of drones, the three of us together for the.
We too haunt New Jersey at night, so it all fits together.
I know the reason why they're not telling us who if the government were to tell us the truth that these drones are in fact, you know, UFOs, it would blow the whole lid off the fact that Trump himself is also a space alien, and they're actually protecting Trump by not kind of because once that
Trump is, I totally agree. Trump is the reason I know there are not any aliens at Area 54 or whatever, because if there would, he'd have a claw on his desk to show people, look at this, we captured this thing in 47, I use it as a paperweight.
But you know, something, this whole thing though, I mean, I don't know what the hell's going on. Okay, I mean, you have very credible people who are going outside and saying, yeah, there's some shit hovering over my house. I mean, you know, like people I know, people I trust. Really? I don't know.
Well, you want to name them?
I don't
you
know.
Name them so we can mock them?
I have a theory. I've solved this. In L.A., I had a house high up in the Hollywood Hills, and every night there'd be a highly orchestrated line of lights in what is clearly an orchestrated manner, lined up in what we like to call the approach pattern to Los Angeles International Airport. You know, most people are not particularly good at night at telling aviation away. And I know Larry Hogan saw three buzzing his garage, and there's some guy on the radio, Mercury Theater, telling you it's an alien invasion. You know, we'll wait and see. I consider myself more of a believer in mass hysteria than I do on disorganized aliens buzzing around Larry Hogan's garage.
You're going to be singing a different story when they suck you up into their capsule.
Well, first of all, I'm their leader, David. We just haven't undone the – we haven't dropped the curtain yet on Operation Takeover.
If there are aliens out there, I invite them to come and suck me up into their capsule, because that would be a fucking great story to write. But here's the thing.
You know what? They'd spit you out in about 5 minutes.
That's probably right. That's probably right. I'm not appealing
to vegetarian. You'd go off on one of your flights of fancy, and they'd say, I don't want to listen to this guy for the next millennia. Yeah.
In all seriousness, listening to people talk about what they're seeing in the sky is the functional equivalent of listening to people like try to talk diagnose their own ailments on the internet. People have no fucking idea what they're looking at. Half the people are looking up there. It's like, oh, hey, that's the aurora borealis.
But listen,
it's like it's not. It's ridiculous.
But here's the thing. What strikes me is this is a parable about so many things about this moment in history. It is a playpen for conspiracy theories.
Yes.
I mean, and Trump, of course, always eager to leap on those.
Fan the flames, baby.
On the fire. Yeah. I presume he's being briefed at this point on these kinds of matters. So he obviously knows more than he's saying, but he's you know, drafting on the current craze. But it also, so that's one element of it. The other is, it is the perfect coda for the end of the Biden years. Okay, it's something where they're acting rationally. They're saying, you know, we're not seeing this as a threat. There's no problem, and so on. This is like Bidenomics, you know. This is like, you know, the economy is good. We see it. Why don't you see it? But it makes them look out of touch.
Well, it's the government doesn't know. They're slow. Only Elon understands. Yeah. And there's some truth to all that. I just know it's pretty easy to go on Amazon buy a $150 drone and attach a glow stick to it and get your neighbors to call the cops because they think the Venetians are trying to come in through the bedroom window.
Have you done that? You sound like you've
done times.
That.
I mean, I'm going to end the drone thing with just a great old Dennis Miller joke, which is, okay, you're the aliens. You've mastered time and space. You've been physics like a pipe cleaner. So what's the last question you haven't figured out? What's going on in a redneck's ass? And so you come here to answer that big question. So I don't know. Call me skeptic.
That's not the best Dennis Miller joke I've ever heard.
It's the best Dennis Miller alien joke.
But David, I would say you could flip your thing around and say it's the perfect code of this era in that Trump is the Biden administration, as you said, is being responsible. And Trump is essentially saying, you guys are liars. They're withholding something from you. Donald Trump, the ultimate pathological liar, is projecting the notion onto Joe Biden that, like, it's Joe Biden who's keeping secrets from you. I'm the one who will always tell you the truth, America. Those guys in the Biden administration are keeping a secret for some nefarious reason. That's the coda for the era.
But if you're the aliens, don't you invade the French Riviera? You really want to go to Orange, New Jersey? Really? You know, 40 billion miles for that, you know, get a hoagie.
Well, remember when Humphrey Bogart was with the Nazi in Casablanca, and the Nazi says, why did you come to Casablanca? And he said, I came for the waters. And and the Nazi said, you're in a desert. And Humphrey Bogart says, I was misinformed. So maybe the aliens were misinformed. We don't know.
Right.
They meant to find a redneck's ass. Instead, they found Orange, New Jersey. So,
but look, that cut from Trump was from an expansive press conference that he had yesterday at Mar-a-Lago, his first since the election. And one of the things that came up, and one of the things that's really serious I want to talk about, is this whole legal assault on the news media. Over the weekend, you guys know, ABC surrendered and settled a suit with Trump over comments that George Stephanopoulos made on his show, characterizing Trump as having been found liable of a rape. Technically, he was not under New York law. He was found liable of something else, but the judge qualified it in his own remarks. It was a suit that they probably would have won. I think Bob Iger was sitting there in Disney headquarters saying, you know what, I don't need this headache. Let's make this go away. Trump's going to be, we got all kinds of regulatory issues we got to worry about.
The rational business decision, but it's absolutely a disaster for ABC News.
And for news generally.
Brain crushing. Yeah, exactly. Now he's going to go sue the Daily Racing Form. I think he's mad about Seltzer. Yeah.
Let's hear that bite.
I see others. I have a few others that I'm doing. I'm doing this not because I want to. I'm doing this because I feel I have an obligation to. I'm going to be bringing one against the people in Iowa, their newspaper, which had a very, very good pollster who got me right all the time. And then just before the election, she said I was going to lose by 3 or 4 points. And it became the biggest story all over the world because I was going to win Iowa by 20 points. The farmers love me and I love the farmers.
He filed that suit this morning.
Yeah, he doesn't want to do it, though.
And the Des Moines Register.
Civic duty. It's not about him, not about grievance, not about still being obsessed over a stupid poll in Iowa.
But here, I mean, first of all, it follows a pattern of Trump's life, which is that he has been the most litigious person in history. And his pattern is to file nuisance suits and then force people to spend a lot of money defending them. And that's what he did with all his a lot of his subcontractors. He'd stiff them. They'd have to file suit with partners and so on.
No, he put them out of business. I saw it in Jersey when I was working for the governor there. But anyway, he's always litigious. He's always the tough guy. And hopefully the next media organ will say no and fight.
Well, how likely, Heilman, do you think that? I mean, he's trying to create a chilling vibe. By the way,
he is creating a chilling effect. I mean, look, there's nothing funny. Literally, there's nothing about this entire thing that's funny. George Stephanopoulos, who essentially repeated what a judge said, And, yes. and was basically not, there's no world in which that would ever pass the actual malice standard in a libel suit. This is an eminently defendable suit. That it's a joke. It would have been a pain. It would have been costly maybe for ABC. Maybe there was something that they were worried about coming out in discovery. That's one theory that people have, but it is on the merits. It's a ridiculous case. There's no way you could clues that you could prove that George Stephanopoulos acted with actual malice, meaning reckless disregard for truth or knowledge of the falsity of the claim, because a judge came out and said that although technically speaking, rape is about a penis and a vagina, that he had raped her with his finger, and that's how most people understood these things. This is just Trump attempting to do one of the most pernicious things he's doing, and he's succeeding at. We are watching the press and watching corporate America bend the knee to Trump, either prophylactically or preemptively, or as a result of threats like this. This is not just Trump being wantonly litigious. This is Trump being strategically litigious and trying to back everyone off. He made a comment at the Time Man of the Year thing, when he got Time Person of the Year, where he said he said he was happy because the press had sort of tamed down. He didn't say toned down. He didn't say calmed down. He said tamed down. With Trump, it's always there's a projection or confession element, and he is trying to tame the press. And so far, it seems to be working.
Look, this is Hungary, okay?
This is how it starts, folks.
Yes, this is how it starts. And let me just say a word about George Stephanopoulos. George is a very, very fine journalist and a guy who cares deeply about fact and truth, which is one of the reasons why Trump offends him. So I feel badly for him because he obviously his company made a decision.
He could have resigned. I'm just saying.
He might still.
I think a lot of George too.
And, he might still. I don't know if he could. He's in a contract negotiation. George is a friend. I agree with you, David. I don't think like the idea that, I mean, Trump says 10 libelous things before 10 more libelous things before breakfast on a given day than George did. I don't know that, like, I mean, again, I'm not offering advice here and I'm not making predictions, but I don't know that George can stay there. I mean, I don't know if you could. If I were in his shoes, I don't know if I could stay there, whether he's resigned today.
Well, and he's at a point in his life where he really doesn't have to either.
Right. Exactly. Right.
So the big question, though, is
it's got to be weighing on his mind.
What does the next media outlet do? I think the pressure to fight will be enormous institutionally. And I think they will, because these cases are hard to win.
We will see. You've got news organizations like the Des Moines Register that don't have deep pockets. You have news organizations, you have other news organizations that don't have deep pockets who are going to think about what they write and say, I think, differently, where it won't come to that. And then you've got these big, very, very significant legacy media companies that are owned by corporations who have all kinds of regulatory issues. I mean, Trump was talking about not renewing ABC's license. And I think he's willing to use all the regulatory levers, all the levers of the Justice Department.
I'm not sure it'll work, but we'll see. Let's get to the politics of it.
One thing I want to ask you guys, though, is I bet you there are a bunch of Americans say, great, sue the goddamn pollsters.
Of course. Yeah. Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. This is a whole democracy thing. I'm for republics.
I mean, I think the canary has already been in the coal mine. I think that's when Bezos killed the Washington Post editorial. Bezos, who just sent $1 million to Trump for his inauguration.
So did Meta.
Yes.
Yeah, but let me just pause for a minute to remind everybody that, of course, Trump is the outlier and the worst and et cetera. But corporations have always been there, needed a new president. Inaugural committees get big fat corporate checks because they're like, well, president's got a lot of power, got to live with them. Here we go. That General Motors gave it to him, even though he just walloped EV subsidies. GM's now the number two seller of EVs in the United States. So the corporate knee bending is standard procedure.
This is true, but as John points out, they didn't do it in 2017, and Trump keeps pointing that out. He said yesterday, my personality must have changed. Now they all want to see me. They all want to give me, money. I think, Mike, this is substantively, qualitatively different because no other president has been so willing
to use
these levers. And you look at his appointees, and he's appointing all kinds of people who, as regulators and as law enforcement officials, will have much wider parameters. So all of these organizations, you know, you're looking at Comcast, Heilman's parent company over there at MSNBC, you know, they're looking to unload MSNBC because it's just too hot for them, and they've got regulatory issues.
Yes, and all of these places are, you know, I mean, Bezos is the paradigmatic example of someone who has all these other business interests where the Post is a small, you know, pimple on the ass of his bottom line. It is qualitatively different in this respect, I think, Mike. One is not just the difference between 2017 and now, but the other is it's one thing to give money to a Republican or a Democratic incoming president who's not threatening you.
Yeah. Trump's the outlier. I agree. What's happened now, if we step back a little bit, because we're going to wind up doing the doomcasting hour, and I can doomcast with the best of them with Trump. But I think where the country is right now, kind of unfortunately, is Trump won fair and square. So that's normalized him. There's kind of this hazy dream going on. Well, he won, and they're covering him like a legitimate elected guy. And, oh, it's interesting. He's got ideas for the Coast Guard. Now, the essential nature of Trump is going to catch up with that, which is why I think we're in for a hell of a first 200 days. I think it'll end in a lot of political disaster for Trump. But right now, there are no shortage of Americans who kind of yawn at all the crimes and sins and want the guy to succeed. And I think corporate America's, there's a new Deloitte study that just came out of CEOs, and they're massively more optimistic about the future of the country and their businesses than they were a year ago, because they see the regulatory cuts and blah, blah, blah. I think it's rose-colored glasses myself, but that's where the gestalt is right now. It's like, oh, we hope this guy succeeds.
They're going to get a massive tax cut in the first quarter. That's likely that's going to be a priority for him, extending his tax cuts, perhaps expanding his tax cuts. Those CEOs are looking at that. They're looking at radical deregulation. And they're, you know, now what they're not calculating is all of the sort of chaos and downstream implications of some of the things that he's going to try to do. But one thing on your point, I want to just get to one. There's this thing that hasn't gotten covered very much that I am obsessed about. Bobby Kennedy Jr. has said this, and I, on the other side of it, I want to talk about the kind of smart bomb down the chimney of legacy broadcast media.
And, you know, one of the things I'm going to advise Donald Trump to do in order to correct the chronic disease epidemic is to ban pharmaceutical advertising on TV.
That was at a rally before the election, but he's talked about it, I think, since. There is a legitimate argument.
Oh, completely. I think it. Yeah.
I mean, one of the things that has inflated pharmaceutical costs in this country dramatically has been pharmaceutical ads and people seeing, heavy people dancing around and talking about, you know, weight loss drugs and
no, it's a big cost driver. It for a lot of reasons, but his reasons are not the good ones.
Well, his may be. Trump may like the idea because I think the number is 25% of revenues on cable TV news and on the evening news
because of the ancient demographic.
I see all these ads. Okay, so let me sure. CNN, stipulate that
it's the red scooters and pharmaceuticals.
It's shit pills and catheter ads, is what it is.
Yeah. It's your audience, guys.
Okay, yeah. Okay, young man.
I'm with the hipsters.
Thank you. You're with the replaced hipsters, is what you are.
Yeah, I'm with the kids.
But the point is, can you imagine, John, as a student of media, what this would do to the bottom line for these news or broadcast news organizations?
Well, it would be the final nail in the coffin of the linear cable news business for sure. Because, like, I mean, no joke. I mean, if you looked at the, especially on Dayside, whether it's Fox News, CNN, MSNBC, if you looked at the proportion of ads that are driven by pharma, it's a vast yeah. Percentage, a vast percentage. It would be crushing to them if that were to happen. But I will say one thing for Bobby Kennedy in this case. And this goes back to the prior topic, and it's actually a question that I would like to ask the two of you about the politics of this, to Mike's point, just to be really, you know, straight on it here. Here's Donald Trump basically swanning around with all these, in this mutual embrace of supplication and favor trading, and there's going to be all this corruption, but with all of these billionaires, you know, there's Mark Zuckerberg putting his hand over his heart while the J6 choir sings the national anthem. I mean, these appalling sights, right? American corporations are not popular. They're not. People don't like, there was a large populist view in America that that corporate tax cuts are not popular. These companies, all big establishment institutions, are not, and that includes the Fortune 500. And Bobby Kennedy, at least, is anti-establishment in taking on the pharma industry. Everything else about Trump right now is really has a big kind of swamp reek to it. And my question politically is this not, well, is it an opening? Or is this potentially a dangerous distraction? Whatever your view is about the lane of economic populism and outsider politics, Democrats became associated with the establishment in the last 4 to 8 years, and that has not helped. And that has not helped their cause. So is this not like painting a giant target on Trump and his fat cat friends going forward that Democrats should be able to exploit in the next 2 to 4 years?
The key thing is that the Democrats try something new. And there's a great Washington Post op-ed today by Rahm Emanuel, a guy who knows something about winning elections from the Democratic side. I'm going to make it Hack's homework to read.
Yeah, it really is. It's I think he takes on a bunch of the stuff that we've been talking about here. I am doing a podcast with him on this week on the Axe Files, and I'm going to ask him about that and a bunch of other stuff. But well worth reading.
Yeah, just quickly, time to back to the pharma thing. The real fight is pharma's power in the Senate. Good luck doing it. It's not the ads that fund CNN and MSNBC and Fox. It's your cable bill. That's where they're relevant. Everybody listening to this is paying money to Rupert Murdoch, whether you watch Fox News or not. And they get the most money of any network, any news network.
But a big percentage of the evening network news budgets.
Look, of linear television, period.
Okay, let's take a break right here for a word from our sponsor, and we'll be right back.
Mike, there are two things I love the most. One is wine, and the other is being naked. How about you?
I drink a lot of wine just thinking about the idea of you running around naked. I'm trying to purge that horrible image from my mind. So here's the thing. If you're like me, you're no wine expert. You can try to fake it a little bit, but wines are complicated. And you don't want to be the idiot who says, give me a box of Old Panther Sweat, and everybody laughs at you. So that is where Naked Wines comes in, a great sponsor of our podcast. It is a subscription service that directly connects you to the world's finest independent winemakers, so you can get award-winning wine delivered straight to your door. With our secret code, HACKS, you can get 6 bottles of good wine for just $39.95.
I've done the Naked Wines thing several times, and it is for real. They have a connection with some great independent winemakers. You tell them the kinds of wine you want. A box arrives at your door. They curate it for you. A box arrives at your door, and it's really, really good stuff. So you're not stuck in a big wine store looking at shelves and shelves and shelves and trying to figure out what's what. And especially during the holiday season, what better than to have some great wine to sit around with family and friends and share? Turn off the noise of the outside world, uncork a bottle, celebrate, you know, the little joys in life.
And you can pause or cancel your Naked Wine subscription deal at any time. So just because you may have a trip coming up doesn't mean you can't enjoy Naked Wines before or after that much-needed vacation.
Now is the time to join the Naked Wines community. Head to nakedwines.com/hacks and put in our code HACKS for both the code and password for 6 bottles of wine for, again, just $39.99 with shipping included.
So, hackaroos, that's nakedwines.com/hacks. hacks and code hacks for 6 bottles of wine for $39.99.
Just one postscript to this. I'm not sure, you know, I said that people would cheer suing pollsters. I don't know that they'd cheer not being allowed to see pharmaceutical ads. I think that they want to know what's available
out
there.
No, people like to self-diagnose.
They'd probably cheer not seeing ads in general. Look, a lot of people are
But to your larger point, you're fundamentally right. The Democratic Party has become, in the minds of a lot of voters, the elite institutional party when people are enraged at elites and institutions. The problem for Donald Trump is he talks like a populist and governs like a royalist, and he is surrounded by plutocrats and billionaires who are going to be looking for ways to advantage themselves. And by the way,
like Soros.
Well, one of the interesting things about Trump in the post-election period is he did this interview with Time magazine, and they asked him about whether he, you know, how he said, you know, well, first they asked him about this. Okay, let's play a montage of clips from the election about prices and particularly food prices.
We will end inflation and make America affordable again. We're going to get the prices down. We have to get them down. It's too much. Groceries, cars, how everything. We're going to get the prices down.
But prices will come down. You just watch. They'll come down, and they'll come down fast, not only with insurance, with everything.
Oh, tomorrow I will end inflation. We will cut your taxes. End inflation, slash your prices. To rapidly reduce inflation,
I will end inflation very quickly. You know,
end inflation, slash your prices. We will cut your taxes. Right. End inflation.
David, I'm seeing a theme here. I think he's going to end inflation and slash prices. Look, he's Juan Perón. He's an authoritarian strongman with left-wing economic populist rhetoric.
Right.
That's his recipe.
But now he says, well, you know, it's not easy to bring those prices down. I'm not sure, you know, I don't know.
Yeah, disaster. They left me a disaster. It'll take a genius to fix.
And a lot of the things that he is talking about, he's still completely, in his rhetoric, at least, committed to tariffs. He said it again yesterday. They're big. They're the most beautiful word in the English language. They're going to make us great again and so on. Between tariffs, those tax cuts, and a couple of other things that he's proposing, prices aren't going to come down. The prices are going to go up.
No, it's all going to end in a massive Hindenburg thing.
But the question is if he's doing all this stuff to advantage his plutocrat friends, and meanwhile prices are going up, does that not create a political problem for him?
Well, yeah, obviously. I mean, the question to me is how much of the tariffs is just talk, and how much is he really going to try to do? And I think the reality right now is, if you judge by what Wall Street thinks, and you judge by the business community's reception to him so far, is they don't take it seriously. They think he's going to do some targeted tariffs, but he's not going to have these giant ones. We'll see. But right now, if Wall Street and the business financial community thought that Trump was going to do the kinds of the tariffs on the scale that he has suggested, there would not be, the Dow would not be where it is right now, because people would recognize that would be economic calamity. So there's a disjuncture between what he's saying and what he's going to do. And that's always been the case with Trump. We'll see what actually happens. If there's now talk that the Fed may stop, may slow down its path on cutting interest rates, right? If that happens and the housing market gets frozen up again, you could very quickly find yourself in a very politically perilous situation for Trump if the normal metrics of politics matter anymore. I mean, you got Steve Bannon out there, you know, saying again just yesterday, you know, let's get Trump reelected in 2028. So, I mean, I don't know how Trump thinks about this right now. Is he worried about short-term politics, or is he worried in the short term mostly about paying off his rich friends?
Or in the alternative, Murphy, is he thinking, I'm gonna have 50 blockbuster executive orders on day one. One of them is going to unleash this deportation thing, and I'm going to do a lot of signifying for the base that will touch their emotional funny bone, and that will give me a lot of running room.
I think you mean erogenous zone, not funny bone, or maybe that's the same thing.
I think it's all a lot simpler than this. I think we're overthinking it.
Well, one thing I want to say is Heilman, he's talking about doing things prophylactically. He's talking about erogenous funny bones. I don't know, man. You need a date.
You know, David only, it's funny that the guy who hears the word prophylactic and immediately thinks something dirty is the one who's accusing me of having my mind in the gutter, but be my guy, but go right ahead.
All right. You guys get a room, you two. Let me explain all this stuff to you guys. First of all, I got a little advice to the Democrats. Knock off the doom casting right now. Because, you know, this hapless Democratic Party, it now wants to whine about Trump before he screws everything up. If I were them, I would be like everybody. We hope he succeeds. Good for people. A booming economy, sure. Good for America.
Sure.
Maybe the CEOs are right. Maybe pulling regulation back. Because, by the way, when corporations do well, everybody does well. So let him root him on gently. Let him fail. Because he will fail. Because he's Donald Trump and he's crazy. And then there'd be nothing but broken hearts and economic trouble and unmet expectations wall to wall, plus criminality, venality, God knows what. But it's going to take a while. So let Trump do what Trump does, bring disaster. Then you play the politics.
I'm not quibbling with that. In fact, I was deeply offended when Rush Limbaugh said on Inauguration Day or thereabouts in 2009 that he was rooting for Obama to fail. I mean, if Donald Trump brings peace and prosperity and can reverse four decades in which the economic standing of working people has kind of eroded, then all power to him. I have no problem with that. But I want Murphy to answer my question, which is, will the big push on deportation, will that keep the fire going for Trump for a while?
I think there are two Trump roads. One is economic success, which I think he's going to have in the short term. He's having it right now. Can he sustain it with policies that probably undercut it? I'm dubious, but we'll see. And the other road is how much of his culture war stuff he wants to pour gasoline on. If I were him, as long as he's having economic success, I'd put the other on the back burner, and his people will still love him because they love success, winner, the Trump gospel. If he does the culture war stuff to the point where real people get hurt and we're throwing kids in camps, U.S. Army Corps of Engineers is literally building camps, it's going to get away in the other mess. It's going to hurt them a lot. But it's all going to take time. I want to basically go into a coma for 200 days and then see where we are. And I think it won't be good for Trump, but it'll be good for the Democrats who, despite themselves, and we'll talk about that later, have an excellent chance to regain power in 22 months.
Heilman probably has some. He can put you in a coma for 200 days if you want to.
Oh, that's ahead. Yes. I have medically induced coma. Medically.
Yeah, I'm going for dental surgery in an hour, so go for it.
Yeah, that's nothing. That's nothing compared to what I can give you. This is my question to the two of you. Okay, Mike, I take your point. Chicken Little, hair on fire, anticipatory dread, not a good political strategy. But what would you guys suggest Democrats and Republicans of conscience, what should they do or say when Donald Trump says he wants to put all members of the January 6th committee in jail? When Donald Trump says right now, as he is currently doing, says he wants to pardon most or all of the January 6th convicted insurrectionists? Should they, again, just to be clear, tactically, should they keep their mouth shut and wait for it to happen? Should they speak out about it?
Mike's saying something different. He's talking about
I understand
a blanket sort of everything Donald Trump does.
I understand.
But they absolutely have to stand up on those kind of things. Absolutely.
I would have thought so, but I just want to be clear.
But you don't, that's not the big debate now, because Trump will tangle himself up. Fetterman's doing it the right way, which is, yeah, I'll talk to anybody. I want to move the country forward, blah, blah, blah. Give Trump the rope to tie himself up into a disaster. And it won't take long. So, you know, the one thing about these cabinet nominees, yeah, they're horrible. I'm against them all, et cetera, et cetera. I'm grabbing my pearls now. I know it's radio. You can't see us. The big mistake Trump's making with them isn't that they horrify the New York Times editorial board. It's that when you put incompetent people into the cabinet agencies, they cannot protect you from the problem factory all those agencies are. And then they're your fault as president. They're really firemen. You know all this, David. You've been inside. Yeah. You want to keep them from doing crazy stuff that'll hurt you. Not only the people, just the bureaucracy there. So he is weakening his ability to be protected from the trouble government automatically gets in. And so all this stuff is going to catch up with him, just not next week.
Okay, then let's take a break right here, and we'll be right back.
The holiday season is really about friends and family. And what most people really want for the holidays, frankly, is to see their favorite people more often. That's why this year, the best gift you can give, besides plane tickets, is the Aura Digital Picture Frame. It's named the number one digital frame by Wirecutter, and they're tough. Aura frames are incredibly smart and easy to use, allowing you to upload unlimited photos and videos directly from your phone to the frame. You don't have to have an MIT degree to work this thing. It's really simple, and people love them.
So what you have basically is a digital display of your favorite memories all the time in front of you that you can change and update and renew as events warrant. And look, I've had it, and I have now my fourth grandkid coming, and it is such a joy to see those pictures and see those faces. So even when you're not together, you're together. What better gift for the holidays? So save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $35 off Aura's best-selling Carver Mat Frames by using promo code HACKS at checkout. That's Aura, A-U-R-A, frames.com, promo code HACKS.
This deal is exclusive to listeners, so get yours now in time for the holidays. Terms and conditions do apply.
The Democratic Party, first of all, should acknowledge the reality, which is that not over just years, but over decades, there has been this radical shift in our economy. There is this, and I've spoken about it here before, this kind of unspoken disdain among, you know, college-educated, white, often Democratic voters who say they want to, you know, they're for working people, but they approach them like missionaries and anthropologists and say, we're here to help you become more like us. And the message is what you do isn't all that important. Well, what they do only makes the country go, okay? We found that out in a pandemic. Show some respect, advocate for people, and acknowledge that institutions have failed people and that we ought to be challenging institutions. The question is, do you challenge them in a constructive way or do you challenge them in a kind of nihilistic way? And I think that that is the fundamental difference. Democrats should not be caught on the side of being the defenders of the status quo, defenders of institutions. I worked in Washington. I think there are a lot of hardworking and good people in all of these agencies, but bureaucracy there's a tremendous amount of inertia around these bureaucracies. They ought to be challenged. Some of them may be outmoded. Some of them may have fundamental problems that ought to be addressed. The question is, how do you address them?
And it's more than just rhetoric, because a narrow majority, by the way, Trump didn't win by that much, but a narrow majority of Americans want to punish government or reject government, and Democrats equal government to most voters. They like it. They want it bigger. They want to boss you around. They got plans for what bathroom you can use. They got a lot of ideas. So that paradigm, based on a lot of Democratic policy and the obsession on identity, is going to be a hard thing to change. But even in their current screwed up state, again, they're set up to do really well in the midterm congressional races.
But I hope they don't read that as a false positive, as they did in 2022.
Yeah, that's what worries me too.
Well, this is what the party is doing right now is everyone looks at it as the Trump margin has shrunken, you know, when all the votes finally got tallied. You hear so many people now, after a couple weeks of like panic and, you know, we must do soul searching the Democratic Party, you now hear people going, well, when you look at it, You know, it's really, he, you know, Trump only won by less than a percent in Wisconsin and by 1% in Michigan and 1.5% in Pennsylvania.
Yeah, we just needed more bumper stickers.
That's kind of how Biden did in 2020. Like, why do we need root and branch reform? And David, to your point, it's that the fact that there's been this erosion with working class voters of all kinds, first white working class voters and Hispanic, now increasingly African-American and Asian-American. And the truth is that it's still the case. 60% of Americans only have a high school degree. So if you, it's a math problem, guys. It's if you can't be a governing national majority if you don't have a decent chunk of non-college voters. And that's where the Democrats have a huge problem.
How about beyond the tactical meaning of it? It's like, if you want to be the party of working...
Well, of working Americans, I agree. But I thought
treat them with respect, you know? Treat the understanding. I know, I make it a lot. Yeah.
No, I'm saying you made that point I did. I wanted to not disagree with you. And I will say, a point that you made, I want to go back to. You got some shit for this at the time, but it's to your point about the establishment and establishmentarianism and institutional representation of the Democratic Party. You know, everyone in America, they hate Washington, they hate the Fortune 500, they hate Wall Street, they don't like any big established institution in the country. They just don't. And when Kamala Harris was going to go and give her closing argument speech on the Mall, that it was a bad idea because, like, being framed by the White House in Washington, D.C. is not where the zeitgeist,
I think that was me. I was saying go to
I remember David saying I'd rather hear her at a suburban mall than the Washington Mall.
Yeah, yeah. I don't know what he was doing there, or she was doing there.
That is what Democrats just have got to stop. I mean, it's the craziest inversion of our time is that the party that 40 years ago was, you know, stick it to the man, middle finger to government, like the spirit of the 60s that 60s liberalism embodied, that now the anti-establishmentarians are all on the other side. And as long as that's the case, and as long as these institutions are as unpopular as they are, yeah, Republicans are going to have a certain kind of cultural advantage.
Joe Biden, Murphy, he got elected as Joe from Scranton, and he governed as Joe from Washington.
As Joe from the Russell Senate office building.
But here's the Democratic problem. I mean, yeah, you can sloganeer and it'll sound better, but the Democrats have to be, in my view anyway, capable of saying, you know what, we're going to build 30 nuclear power plants because it's the cleanest energy, we're going to create a lot of jobs. And then somebody in the media is going to say, no, our environmentalists who are all wealthy and college educated and all these are going to like it. Screw them. We're in the hard hat business. We're going to start building stuff here.
I understand your point.
But they can't do that. That's my point. The squishy side will win.
I don't think that's true. I don't think the squishy side will win. What I'm saying is the problem is deeper than that.
Yes.
The problem is deeper than that. And there has to be a real rethinking of the question people should be asking is, why is it that so many people feel so alienated from institutions, so alienated from government? And I'm not sure that your point, Mike, it totally answers that. But I want to raise one other thing, and then I have one other bit of sound I want to play that goes to the nominees because we're going to, you know, Tom Homan was in Chicago a couple of weeks. I haven't been here for a couple of weeks, so I'm catching up. I got a lot on my mind, you guys. So Tom Homan, who's the border czar of the Trump administration, the former ICE guy, was in Chicago speaking at a Republican fundraiser, by the way, and he basically menaced the very unpopular mayor of Chicago, Brandon Johnson, and challenged him to challenge them when they come in and try and enforce their deportation orders, and J.B. Pritzker as well. And it occurs to me that one of the things that they are hoping for and are going to try and provoke are confrontations with Democratic politicians in big cities over this deportation issue. And if they are trying to deport if they're trying to deport people who have been convicted of crimes, I'm not sure the public is going to be I think the public's going to fall on their side. And the question is, how do Democratic politicians play this? The mayor of Denver said, originally you know, he kind of said, we're going to draw a line at the board, we're going to stand up to the, and then he backed off on it right away. But what is the proper posture for Democratic politicians in dealing with that issue, Mike?
Well, they're going to reflexively doomcast and say, how dare you? And they're going to go on MSNBC and say there'd be gunfire on the streets, Trump revolution. You know, I mean, it's going to be all the same noise we have about this stuff. Brandon is the worst mayor in the country, in my view. But he's a thug secretary, this guy. He's the wrong guy for the job. I mean, it's terrible. But right now, it's like two drunks yelling at each other. We'll see what actually happens. And if it happens, it's horrible, and I'll condemn it louder than anybody. And Democrats should condemn it if it happens.
Well, yes. Let's just say this. Family separation in the first Trump administration had some pretty terrible human consequences. And so for Democratic politicians to remember that, and when they hear Trump talking about doing something that's similar to that and on a larger scale, for them to express concern, it doesn't seem unreasonable to me, Mike. And I think that you don't have to have hair on fire doomcasting. I think to be worried about it, both substantively and is substantively fair and politically not terrible, not disadvantageous. I do think the question is what actually happens. And I agree, David, to your point, if Trump ends up doing kind of a fake deportation thing, which is to say nothing like on the scale, which I think is what's going to happen, not to say that there's not going to be really people deported, but you're going to go to a bunch of jails, you're going to get a bunch of undocumented immigrants who are already convicted criminals and send them back to their home countries. If that is the scale of it, Democrats should be fine with that and shouldn't make a big deal out of it. And Democrats have to be tougher on immigration if they're going to be effective politically. But if you end up in a place, to Mike's point, we'll see whether, I just don't think Trump, for a lot of reasons, not just because of the television images, but because most of the business community has no tolerance for what it would do to the labor market for him to go around and start grabbing undocumented immigrants who've been working as law-abiding citizens for some number of years and trying to root them out and throw them back. The Chamber of Commerce would hate that more than anyone.
What I'm saying is that if he goes the sort of deportation light route, I mean, it's going to be real, but because, you know, remember, the Obama administration
deported a lot of people,
and they were criminals. I mean, they prioritized.
Well, yes, I mean, that is the non-controversial thing to do. The question is, does he start sweeping community, you know, all the horror show stuff? But I don't think he will. If he does, it'll hurt him politically.
No, I'm making a different point, though. I agree with you. If he does all those things, that should be resisted. The question is, do Democratic politicians in these cities see it in their interest to have the fight,
yes,
regardless of what, and I think Trump is gaming this out to try and create those confrontations.
No, he wants the fight. We're going to see it here in California. We're sanctuary USA here, and it's like Gavin Newsom's trying to pick all kinds of fights with Trump because in his interest, and voters here being a blue state are happy with it. You know, fighting Trump is good politics, and from Trump's point of view, fighting California is good politics. So yeah. It's pro wrestling. They're going to have dinner afterward and talk about best places to campaign in New Hampshire.
If it's just criminals, convicted criminals, and that's it's the deportation light model, David, Democrats would be well advised to not take that bait. The last thing the Democratic Party needs on any level is to be associated with lax immigration policies going forward.
But they'll fall for the trap, won't they? I think they will.
Yeah, I mean, there are nuances that are going to be, you know, like, you know, there's talk that they're going to go into churches. And I mean, I think they've intimated that in places where they haven't gone before. I mean, I think that they are going to look for that confrontation. And this is something that Democratic politicians have to think about. Because, yes, I think you have to stand up on principle if this turns into something that, you know, the worst case scenario.
Of course. But,
yes. So, you know, I'm sure we'll get a lot of shit for having said that here. But I mean, the other part, what I'm saying, which is be thoughtful about how you react to this. Don't play Trump's game.
Yes.
Yeah. But do you think the mayor of Chicago will be thoughtful in this fight?
Well, I mean, even.
How about a little grace, a little mercy here?
Yeah, a little kindness.
In the holiday season.
Let's not condemn him. If we're not going to condemn Trump anticipatorily, we should not condemn the mayor of Chicago anticipatorily. Let's wait to see what he does.
Well, I mean, he's sort of being condemned by voters in Chicago, not anticipatorily. I mean, you know, the guy's sitting there with like a 15% approval rating.
Yeah, he's earning it.
Yeah, fair enough.
I voted for him 5 times and I'm disappointed.
He may end up suing pollsters for the numbers that he's getting.
It could be class action. I know about 100 Pauls who'd like to sue a pollster.
Okay, then let's take a break right here and we'll be right back.
So, Murphy, as you know, as we've talked about, I've been laid up for a couple of weeks with a bum wheel that got repaired. And so I've had to spend a lot of time lying down with my foot in the air. And one of the things that made it tolerable was that I've been lying on my Helix mattress.
Oh, that's good.
I've been bragging about for several years. I got one because they were a sponsor of ours and they offered me a mattress. And it was one that was sort of tailor-made for me. They have their quiz and they hook you up with the perfect mattress for your needs, and it's honestly been great, and it's one of, and it's made my convalescence a lot easier. So I am more enthusiastic than ever about Helix mattresses.
Yeah, look, I'm proud we have them as a sponsor. You finally jawboned me into getting one. We got one of the kid mattresses and our daughter has it and she loves it. It's a good product, so I'm glad. You know, Helix is one of our only advertisers that says, screw the talking points, just talk from your heart. Because we know it's a good product and you can really check it out. They can customize the mattress to you. You just go on, of course, helixsleep.com. You dial it in. They send it to you. You get to live your own kind of sci-fi movie when you open the box and the thing grows out. It's pretty cool. And they have a tremendous money-back guarantee. So you got nothing to lose. And frankly, you know, we're not going to sell you a bum mattress, because if we ruin your sleep every night, we're going to have to hire security. I know how that can screw up somebody's life to have insomnia because they don't have the mattress right. So give it a try. That is our message to you. Give Helix a try. You got money back guarantee. You can zero it in on that website. It's their secret. Yeah. You will thank us for it. And we got a great deal for you.
Yeah, head to helixsleep.com/hacks. That's H-E-L-I-X, sleep.com/hacks to get this 20% off your next mattress and 2 free pillows for all mattress orders.
And the pillows don't care about politics. Check it out, everybody.
We haven't talked at all about the nominations, really.
Let's not do that. Let's talk about your foot, David.
My foot is healing. I had surgery on my foot, a little reconstruction on my foot about 2 weeks ago. It's healing well. I've got
we're down to 5 toes now. We've all been waiting for this.
One month.
It took a while
until I'm on my feet again, and I will be able to kick some ass, man. So I'm very happy, and my thanks to Dr. Mitchell, the fine surgeon down here in Phoenix, who did a yeoman job on this, and so I'm good.
So my question is, and we're all glad to know you're doing better.
Yeah.
On the knee wheelie thing, you're imprisoned in for a while because you can't put weight on a foot that's been surgically helped. Do you have one of those orange pennants on the stick? Or no, you're going with the original.
Well, what I need to get is a bell on my, because I zip around my house on this knee thing, and I whip around the corner, and I almost sideswipe my wife. So what I need is a bell on the thing. But getting back to the nominations,
this is a good preview of the David Axelrod on a Rascal era to come. That's what the retirement's going to be like around the Axelrod home.
Yeah. Honk if you hate Trump bumper sticker. I can visualize it.
I'm going to get one of those Mr. Magoo horns on the thing. So anyway, you know, one of the things that occurred to me when I was laid up was, and I was watching all the coverage of the horrible shooting in New York, of the capture of this young guy, Luigi Mangione, of this fall of Syria and so on. These things could not have come at a better time for Trump and his nominees, because Wegseth's problems were all the news, you know, Tulsi Gabbard, all of that, you know, Kash Patel, they got pushed down to the third or fourth story. And in the void, the MAGA boys were able to take Republican politicians out and talk some sense to them, if you know what I mean. You know, and the Heritage Foundation planned a media buy that they announced in 9 states. There are 9 senators they were targeting who show some modicum of moderation and independence. And Lisa Murkowski, the senator from Alaska, who has shown more than a modicum of independence, was questioned the other day at a, I think it was a No Labels event in Washington. And here's what she had to say about where we are.
But I think it's going to be hard, quite honestly. I think it's going to be hard in these next 4 years because you have an administration coming in that has had an opportunity to kind of see how things work, what didn't work, and now we've had 4 years to think about it, and the approach is going to be everybody toe the line. Everybody line up. We got you here, and if you want to survive, you better be good. Don't get on Santa's naughty list here, because we will primary you.
That is about it, isn't it?
Yeah, it's totally it. And Elon will throw a lot of money into the primary until he and Trump have the great high school breakup, which is coming. Yeah, I mean, look, it's they're not. I think one or two may get clipped, but not enough will. And as I said before, net is bad for Trump because you'll have people who can't deliver in the bureaucracy. Like Hegseth, he is an insult, that nomination, to the career people in the U.S. military. But if he gets the job, the military, the uniform military, will eat him alive. Those generals are smart. I worked there once. They will give him a plane and a funny hat and a badge and let him fly around and inspect bowling alleys for 4 years. And they're going to do what they got to do. Same thing with Tulsi at NDI. The CIA will just stop sharing information, which is what they want to do anyway. It's really bad, but Trump is the loser in all these things over time.
Well, David, let me ask you this question. As you sat there in your recuperative bed and took a measure of the dynamics unfolding, where Hegseth, who was basically close to being done at one point,
yes,
has mounted a bit of a rebound,
yeah,
in terms of his prospects for getting confirmed.
Yeah.
Kash Patel basically has people like John Cornyn saying, you know, and Tom Tillis and others saying, yes, he's on a glide, yes, path.
Yes, it's Cash and Kerry. Yes,
RFK Jr. is now doing his rounds this week. There are many people who think that he might get through. I hate asking a predictive question, but if you looked at those four, the Gabbard, RFK Jr., Kash Patel, and Hegseth, like the four most egregious nominees, how many of them in the end do you think get confirmed? You know, in the end, bottom line.
Three.
I think they all could get confirmed.
Yeah.
I think they all could get confirmed. I mean, look, here there are questions like, what is Mitch McConnell going to do? He's been very outspoken about RFK Jr. and vaccines, and I think powerfully so, because he had childhood polio.
And the fact that RFK Jr.'s like main advisor wants to end the polio vaccine,
yes,
is really playing right into the old McConnell constituency of one.
Yeah, no, how to charm him, charm him.
So that is, I mean, there is apparently real concern on the Intelligence Committee. I mean, Tom Cotton is going to be chair of the Intelligence,
yeah,
Committee, apparently killed Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s daughter-in-law for CIA deputy director. The idea being that Bobby wanted her to go in there and investigate the assassination of his uncle, JFK.
But you think all four could get through?
They could.
I'm concerned about that. I don't think that Collins and Murkowski will go along with all four. I think maybe that Murkowski will go along with none. Maybe Collins won't. But we've seen this movie before. We've seen it on Supreme Court nominations and so on. I think this period in which the brass knuckle crowd has come out and made clear what their intentions are. And Mike makes a really important point. Never before has a president had someone with unlimited resources saying, I will spend untold,
yep,
fortune to beat you in a primary if you don't toe the line. And we know, you know, survival is the fundamental first priority of people in public office. And so, you know, yeah, I worry about it.
And as you know, David, a lot of Republicans capitulated even before Elon Musk was just the mere whiff of a primary threat caused them to capitulate in the,
yes,
first Trump term. But Murphy, you said that you thought that three would get through. Who's the one you're thinking of that you think is the one that is most likely not to get through?
You know, it's close. I think RFK may implode. I think the vaccine thing can steamroll. And don't underestimate Big Pharma in the Senate. I think the most dangerous is Patel and Vogt, who's going to get OMB, which is an agency nobody knows what it is, but has massive power. And he knows what he's doing. And if I had two magic beans, I would stop Patel and Vogt, followed by Kennedy. Tulsi and Hegseth will be isolated by the pros. But it's still a disaster. I mean, we're literally in triage here. Oh, well, okay, I guess we have to cut off the leg and one eyeball and we can save the patient here. That's the world we're in.
Patel is in the position where he is someone who has no, as far as we know to this point, there's no personal scandal. It's purely ideological and purely on substance. And no
one. And the corruption of an agency that should be non-political.
Yes. I think he's the most dangerous one. But I also think that in the history of the United States Senate, under Trump and anyone else, that like substantive ideological things never sink nominees. The things that sink nominees are scandals of some kind, right? It's not, you know, it's some kind of personal defect. I think Patel is the most dangerous and the most likely to get confirmed. And when people ask me why I'm worried about it, I don't, you just say, have you heard of J. Edgar Hoover? Have you heard of J. Edgar Hoover? It's like we have a recent analogy to what a FBI director run amok can do. This is not speculative. Anyway, listen to him.
Yeah, on that point, by the way, February is the 50th anniversary of the appointment by President Ford of Edward Leavy, who was then the president of the University of Chicago, as Attorney General. And the mission that he gave Edward Leavy was restore public confidence in the Justice Department and the FBI. And Edward Leavy, and this was after Hoover, and this was after Watergate. Edward Leavy and two attorney generals going down around Watergate. Edward Leavy built a series of norms and rules and laws to insulate the Justice Department from political interference. When I was in the White House, I was not allowed to call the Attorney General. I was certainly not allowed. I only saw the FBI director when he came in to brief the president on something. I was not allowed to contact the FBI director. The only person who could was the White House counsel. And those rules were there for a reason. And now what Patel represents is a tearing out of all of those protections, root and branch, and he sees himself as a functionary, a political functionary for the president. And by the way, the first time there's a terrorist attack on domestic ground, which the FBI has done a great job of trying to prevent, or some other catastrophe, and I don't wish this, and I hope it doesn't happen. I think the question's going to be, how the hell do we have this guy running this operation?
Oh, completed. That's back to my point about putting competence in charge of a very complicated Lucy and the assembly line factory, and things are going to get worse and ultimately be the president's fault. That's why, again, I think this whole thing is going to crescendo in a bad way, but it's going to take time. And the sad thing is the country's going to pay the price.
So we only have a little bit of time left. I want to say a few things because we're going to come back at the after.
Are they going to be cheerful? Is anything going to be cheerful?
A few things. We're almost out of time.
Please.
We're just reporting the news here, man. But the I just want to say how grateful I am for you guys and for all of those who participated here. This is a joy to come here once a week and bullshit with you guys. I ultimately do have faith that we will navigate through this period as a country. I don't wish for Trump's failures, but I do. But I'm resolute that when he offends fundamental basic principles of democracy, we're going to deal with that. We have to stand up to that. But there are a whole lot of good people in this country, and there's so much good about this country, and we've gone through difficult periods before, and we'll navigate this as well. But one of the ways we're going to do it is with good humor and good cheer here, at least. And I just want to say thank you guys for that opportunity.
Well, thank you. I had no idea during your convalescence you've been in online rabbinical school here.
Seriously.
That was inspiring and gracious. I feel the same way. I love you, Muggs.
He's still here, Miss P. He's still high on his pain medications.
I'm sober. Jesus. I'm sober. I said this. I was
sure,
sober.
Sure.
Yeah, exactly. Save some for us. Well, happy holidays and Merry Christmas. Peace on earth, everybody.
To all,
yes,
our
to all of you.
We appreciate all you hackaroos out there.
It's not the $114 we make for the ads. It's you people, because we love doing this. And onward to a year. Don't give up on America. Play the long game.
Happy New Year.
All right. Yeah. See you guys.